G'day everyone. My name's Lindsay. I'm going to talk about GNOME deployment specifically. Well, not exactly GNOME specifically, but just desktop deployments in general. So it's going to be a bit ranty. I want to get people involved and just talk about desktop Linux and deployment situations and that sort of thing. But so let's go. Right, so I work on a project called Merlin for a large national hire company, which I'll probably accidentally mention a couple of times. It's a 400-seat desktop deployment, specifically for a point-of-sales environment. The Linux exists to basically facilitate the application that's running on top of it. The application is entirely web-based. It's been coded to work against Firefox, so it's pretty cool. It's running entirely on Fedora, primarily because when we started the project, we didn't want to pay exorbitant licensing fees to Red Hat. They were going to charge us about $800 a copy for Red Hat Linux at the time. And it's a combination of GNOME and XFCE. So most of the front counters that are using this point-of-sale system are running XFCE, although they are going to be converted over to GNOME sometime in the coming year. We're using GNOME specifically on the servers, so they don't get a lot of use, but also branch manager PCs, which is this other class of user, basically unrestricted desktop, they use GNOME because it's just there and it just works. So I'm going to talk about some of the successes and failures that I've found with doing a desktop Linux deployment. So technical problems. We actually found that on the whole, they're relatively easy. They're not that difficult to try and deal with. Hardware is interesting because of the vendor that we get our hardware from. It's IBM / Lenovo, and they're not very consistent with their hardware. Case in point, when I was doing some analysis last year, we found at the end of last year, what was originally meant to be a four different types of PC environment. Sorry, no, originally a two types of PC environment, then a four. Is now actually a 14 different piece of hardware type environment. And that's basically because, technology changes over time. You can't guarantee that you're going to get the same desktop or same piece of physical piece of hardware, from one year to the next. Unfortunately, Lenovo like changing their hardware very regularly, even within the same line of hardware. So it makes it difficult when, you need to get X working. And it also means that, a branch may have a collection of different types of machines, and it'll work, GNOME or whatever the desktop environment will work really, really well on, counter one, but then counter two and counter three, which have got different hardware, doesn't work really as nicely. We also have interesting problems with X as well, with some of those pieces of hardware. For example, if you go back to the console with Control Alt F1 and then head back to X, your entire display dies and you lose everything that you've done. In terms of the actual software itself, GNOME and XFCE, they're really nice. They're just like any other bit of software that you sort of install on the system, put a few defaults, and then users go off and use them. I'll talk a bit more about locking down the environment and that sort of thing. And from deployment as well, it works fairly painlessly. Maintenance is interesting, but that's more of a problem with the way that we manage change within the environment, or used to manage change within the environment. With things like Savion in the future, this is going to be like unbelievably less complex and a real pleasure to deal with. In fact, in the tests that we have done with Savion, it was so amazing how easy it was to set up the GNOME environment and create a lockdown environment that normal branch users would be able to use. Right, end user acceptance. This is something that you normally have to worry about, or you would think you have to worry about, but users actually don't care as long as their applications are there. They're using OpenOffice, they're using Firefox. Most of the things that they are dealing with internally are all web-based applications, so it works in basically the same way. The other thing that we do is we theme the desktop environment to look as similar to Windows as possible. We originally tried making it a bit more Linux-y / GNOME-y. And it was nice fast because we're all used to it, the people who work on the project, but the users are like, what the hell is this shit? So we changed everything back to look like Windows and Windows XP in particular, and the users absolutely love it. It's not a problem. Firefox is great. There are some interesting problems and interactions with Java, specifically with Lotus Notes. Unfortunately, they use Lotus Notes for all their email. But Firefox on the whole is pretty good. We don't really have too many problems with it. You know, we run the app in full screen and then it just works. I can talk about an interesting fuck-up in regards to Firefox a bit later on, if you're all interested. The other thing is responsiveness of the system. Generally, it's pretty good, except when you turn on LDAP authentication. As soon as you do that, things get very, very unreliable, regardless of whether you have NSCD on or not, for caching all of your username and password lookups and that sort of thing. But as long as you have a reliable LDAP server that you're talking to, and NSCD is working correctly, and you know PAN LDAP is all working fine, it's generally not too much of a problem. And finally, the sysadmin response, the people who are actually dealing with the system day in, day out. Again, LDAP is a really big thing for them because they have to manage user accounts, and that's not really a desktop-related thing, though we use an interesting combination of little add-ons for PAM to manage mounting their home directories remotely. So every person, every terminal within the branch, when it logs in, it executes this module called PAMMOUT. Basically, PAMMOUT will connect to the local branch server and grab and basically open up, pass the username and password that PAM was passed to authenticate to that SAMBA server, and then it'll mount that user's home directory locally. You know, nothing particularly flashy, but it does the job. And that tends to work really well, though, because LDAP is the thing that we're authenticating against, and because SAMBA is the thing that is talking to LDAP, because all the information is in one place. We have some interesting interactions when, you know, LDAP doesn't reliably behave. And that's not necessarily a GNOME thing, it's just a desktop Linux thing in general. It's going to be absolutely insane in a large environment if you're going to try and manage your entire environment without some sort of centralized authentication. We found that LDAP is fantastic for that, except that the implementations of LDAP are pretty shithouse. We're looking at switching to something like Fedora Directory Server in the next year, and from conversations that I've had with other people, they've done similar things, and their desktop deployments have become exponentially more reliable and stable. Epiphany as well. Epiphany is fantastic because with Savion, it integrates very, very cleanly into you know the desktop environment, so you can maintain things through gconf a lot more easily. You can you know set up your Savion profiles and say you know all the users they can't type in funky URLs of FTP or file or you know stuff like that, and you lock down the interface and you make it very, very simple just for those end users. The other fantastic thing about Epiphany is because it just uses Gecko as the rendering engine, the application is tested against Firefox, but we know that it is going to reliably work with Epiphany. And certainly for the next phase of the desktop Linux deployment, we're going to be heavily relying on Epiphany and Savion integration quite a bit more. Okay, so some of the failures that I tend to find in just the desktop Linux space in general. End user acceptance, OpenOffice. I actually don't mind OpenOffice too much, except that I don't use it, so that's probably why I don't mind it too much. However, the particular company that I work for, there is a lot of end-user generated content. You know, lots of their financial systems are run out of Excel spreadsheets with lots of complex macros. They don't reliably work in OpenOffice. There was such a backlash about it to the point that they almost actually considered rolling back the desktop Linux deployment for a large percentage of the machines that were out there just so that they could get their content working more reliably. And that is actually more of a problem to do with foresight of the IT department. When we originally pitched the idea of doing desktop Linux to them, they're like, this is fantastic. And we very specifically highlighted it to them that, you know, you're going to have problems with your documents. You're going to have problems with OpenOffice. And they're like, oh, okay, that's fine. You know, we're going to be webifying all of our processes and that sort of thing. And our project has been going on for quite some time. And this was about 4 years ago that they said that they would do this. And you know, we're at the pointy end of the deployment now, and most of the machines are out there, and there's no centralized web-based documentation. So you know, you can route around that problem entirely of OpenOffice and the integration with Office by you know using some sort of centralized document management system or writing some web app to automate some task. But that's, to me, that's certainly one of the barriers to entry of using Linux on the corporate desktop, at least for more general uses. For the point of sales environment, you know, it actually doesn't matter too much. They're not opening up open office documents and you know, doing stuff in them. That's not too much of a problem. But for knowledge workers within the branch, it is a big issue, a huge sticking point. And you know, to the point where they were seriously considering rolling back the deployment. All right, the other things, more things that are out of my control. The technical side of things are the stuff that I have control over, but the technical side of things also tend to be the problems that are very, very easily solved. The things that give us a lot more contention are sort of business and management related decisions and the way that they see the particular project going. So I find that to get Linux into an organization, or desktop Linux in particular, you tend to find that you have to bundle it with something else. For example, if you're going to... the way that it worked in this particular case was these guys needed a new point-of-sale system, right? So they had something that was custom-developed, and one of the things that they said was, okay, we want to try and reduce our infrastructure costs overall, and we want to make things a bit more flexible, so we're going to go with Linux. Which is fantastic because, you know, that's how we got Linux into the door and you know, got everything up and running. The problem with that is that the point-of-sales application that was developed is not particularly fantastic, and there have been a lot of problems with project management to the point where the application is very, very, very delayed in being delivered. In fact, the rollout is only happening now. They've gone live with 45 branches, which is fantastic, but that's just introduced a whole bunch of other problems. And to management, they don't really see the distinction between the point of sales application and desktop Linux. They just see it as being, oh, that project that is taking fucking forever. So it's a bit of a problem because the way that you get it in, it's simultaneously a double-edged sword, right? You want to be able to get desktop Linux into the organization by bundling it with something like this. But if the other people who are, you know, working on the other part of the project who are out of your control don't deliver, then your project just gets lumped and, you know, a big rubber stamp of fail gets put on it. The other reason they sort of went with Linux in the first place was because the IT manager that they had at the time sort of played a bit of buzzword bingo in that he had been hearing a lot about, you know, this is the year of the Linux desktop. And he's like, wow, wouldn't it be totally awesome if we could just do that, and that'd be fantastic. Without necessarily thinking about how practical it was for their particular cases. Now, I think that they've made a sound business decision in choosing Linux for the desktop. But you know, there are points where, when it actually comes down to it, from a financial position, it would have been cheaper for them to use Windows on the desktop than it has been so far to use Linux on the desktop. That's the fact of the matter. And that's a combination of, you know, poor project management, and it being a whole learning experience and creating things from scratch and, you know, getting them up to speed with the way that the system works. But, you know, that's basically the fact of the matter. You could get, you know, there are countless different organizations out there that you can hire to do your Windows deployment for you, and it'll just be done. And because of that project bundling, you have problems with management buy-in. Again, you know, they don't want to be particularly associated with that project because, you know, everything is sort of failing there. And for Linux, for them, in the big picture sort of thing, it works really, really well in that point of sales environment. I mean, the desktop Linux stuff is rock solid. They don't have to worry about all the normal things of, you know, viruses and malware. So you dodge that bullet entirely. But they're not going to move to using desktop Linux in other parts of their organization for, you know, more administrative things. People who are working very specifically on, you know, finance or marketing or, you know, administration or any sort of business administration, they're not going to switch to that. But that's really a testament to the flexibility of Linux in that it works very, very well in niche markets. I should just jump to the next slide. As long as it's sort of tied in with that project bundling. If you can get Linux into an organization, your best chance is trying to bundle it with, you know, oh, you will also get this application to do point of sales or inventory management or whatever. And Linux fills the niche fantastically of, you know, that supporting infrastructure for users to log in and do whatever they need to do. But in terms of actually, you know, people, knowledge workers in the business and just administration in general using it day to day, it's not going to happen anytime soon. And that's mainly because most of the applications that they rely on are so heavily entrenched in the Windows world that it's going to be incredibly difficult to migrate them away other than, you know, let's start a project to Webify this particular business process and that sort of thing. But again, you know, that's got a whole bunch of other problems associated with it. The other thing for the client is skill and flexibility. Now, the way that I sort of explain the problem is that for them, they don't have a lot of skill in desktop Linux, but it provides them an awesome amount of flexibility. For Windows, they've got bucket loads of skill. They've got all the different people that they have there already. Whenever they bring anybody in, already know something about, you know, managing Windows deployments. But again, it's not very flexible or stable for that matter. I mean, that's a sort of a broad statement to make, but we certainly find that, like I was saying with the niches before, Linux fills it and is very flexible and it fits the niche absolutely perfectly. So it's really a business decision of, oh, okay, I could spend more money focusing on, you know, doing the Linux stuff and training my people up to speed and getting them familiar with the environment, and in the end having a better product overall, or better system overall, or I could pay, yes, 5 minutes. Or I could pay a pittance to this organized, you know, some random IT consulting firm that will come in and do my Windows deployment for me, but I'm going to have an endless number of nightmares trying to deal with the fallout of actually managing a Windows deployment in, you know, a large environment. The final thing is sort of business awareness. The business really doesn't really care all that much about what they use. They just care that it works and they can do their business. Regardless of whether they eventually decide to switch away from Windows and switch away from Linux and move to Windows, they're still going to have, you know, the same number of problems. It's just going to be different problems in a completely different area. And sure, the labor may be cheaper, but I don't think that you'll get, you know, as quality an engineer or architect working on the problem as if you were doing something with desktop Linux. Because people who work on desktop Linux are, you know, few and far between, and they tend to know what the hell they're doing. So I think more than anything, this is a message of hope that from the technical side of things, we've achieved what we've always wanted to achieve, which is we can get Linux on the corporate desktop. The trick is to sell it to management, probably by bundling it with something else, and then once it's in, keep on selling them on the fact that they're making, you know, they're saving so much money in doing it this particular way. Cool. Questions? Yes. Yes, it requires a fair amount of brain surgery, but it is possible.
I do think bugging the Fedora Drift developers get down.
Yeah.
Wonder it would be easier to make force open all that to their security environments and to use, make the Fedora Drift 7 to open all that when it needs to be all that client.
Right.
Or support from this from the Zilla all that client scared.
Cool. Yes.
The thing that I don't think about the desktop for the one thing that you tell Rachel, that's the real thing.
Absolutely. So the question was, with the desktop Linux, was OpenOffice really the sticking point, especially with Excel? And
so this wasn't the thing you should document.
Yep, that's right.
I saw an interesting, it was just surprised, but there are instruments that make jobs caused by tiny little errors in calculation of the
It'd be nice to switch everybody over to GNU-Meric or whatever, but... Yeah, I mean, there's a huge reliance on that user-generated content. You know, the business has sort of grown from a smaller to medium-sized business. It's a higher company. Yeah. So they use a lot of spreadsheets for... Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Interestingly enough, at the Slug event last Friday, the Microsoft people who were there were saying that they're going to actually open up all of their document standards in the coming months, which would be amazing if true, and that would just eliminate all those problems. Yeah, including the old ones, not just the new ones, which would be fantastic because we just solved that problem instantly. Yeah, similar experience. I think that the cases where we found that the documents actually, the you know, Excel or Access or whatever, don't really work is somebody from some division will go, oh, okay, I really need this quick application to do this, and they'll go off and develop it in Access and find that, you know, it works great, but it's horribly inefficient and it falls over. So somebody then goes and rewrites it in PHP, and then, you know, so you're sort of incrementally fixing the problem, but it's only once the problem surpasses a particular stage. There are still, you know, 15, 20 other Excel spreadsheets that are core parts of their business that we can't just convert because, you know, they're simply not complex enough.
All I was going to say is the reason that my mother
it's a low-hanging fruit, and people will pick the low-hanging fruit, so... Yeah. One last question. Yeah, absolutely. There are lots of different ways that you can subvert the flaws by, you know, running a terminal server in your branch and exporting the particular applications. And that works for 99% of the cases. It's just, you know, the other 1% that just happened to cause the other 99% of the problems. So, all right. Thank you very much.
There's a socket right here, you can use.
Yeah, but that's not good.
Well. Do you guys mind if we unplug this momentarily?
Maybe
it's... Is that going to die anything?
No, people trip over. Let's do this.
Okay. Do you use Bug Wrapper?
Never
use Bug Wrapper. Oh, really? The problem is getting all of the different style lines. Mine was much more consistent. I just have nice stuff.
The thing that I love about Tango is that it's like this whole world of clip art. It's famous.
Got one of these platform PCs.
Yeah.
See if it can do it.
Yeah. Oh, that can be interesting.
Yeah.
Quite advanced. You have to tell it the mode that you want it to be.
Just mode and thing.
Oh wow. You don't have to do 800 by 600. You have to do 100 over 600. That's impressive.
Wow, that's crap.
Maybe I need to restart the X7.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
What?
Friend of mine.
No.
I'm saying.
Wow. Yeah, I'm son of compass. Okay. Right, can everyone hear me? Okay, sorry for the delay. Oh, you want to introduce me?
Everyone, it's David Slayton talking about policy care. Welcome, David.
Thanks. Yeah, sorry about the delay. It's kind of new, this small laptop, and getting the display working didn't really work, so that'll eventually. So, yeah, I'm going to be talking about PolicyKit and what that means. So locking down the free desktop is an interesting statement. I mean, that's my name, by the way, my email address. So lockdown, free desktop. I mean, who here thinks that sounds a bit strange? Like, no one? Oh. I was expecting people to like yell, you hate freedom, why you want a lockdown? But I guess Lindsay's talk before highlighted a few areas why it's important to lock down the desktop, dealing with users, deployments, people not used to using computers. So the way I look at it, it really comes down to two things. It's like settings and there's more privilege operations. Things like connecting to a network. So settings, it's what we got covered pretty well in GNOME today. Things like setting your desktop background, you want the logo for the company, application launches, and the general look and feel. So users can't go and change on a point of sale PC what the toolkit looks like. So the next user will be very confused. So we have gconf, and it has all these like fancy lockdown features, and it works very well. It's gonna be probably replaced by gconf for gsettings, whatever name it'll end up with. So we're in pretty good shape there. The other area is privilege operations. That's things like connecting to a network, configuring the OS, setting the time and date, installing software, maybe only just updating the OS with trusted patches from your vendor. So these are all very different things, and the way it works today on most Linux distributions is that you put in the root password or you put in your own password. So it's very either or. It's not very fine-grained. And that's a problem, I think, when deploying things in large environments. So I kind of like to split it into two different use cases. The consumer OS, that's someday what I want to put on my mom's PC. And more the enterprise OS. And both of them share a bit some reasons why you want the lockdown. You want to avoid people to break their computer so they can't use it anymore. You don't want them to be able to uninstall all the desktop OS. And you want fine-grained access control. The enterprise OS, that's sometimes some legal reasons why you want to do it, like Sarbanes-Oxley. In the US, you want auditing. And the consumer OS, one feature you might want is parental controls for your kids. So that's pretty much why you want lockdown. So next thing I'm going to talk about is annoying password dialogues like these. They need what you turn into some kind of huge passphrase. This one talks about a guy called Root. I mean, most of you guys probably know him, but as long as you have more than one password, it's pretty difficult to manage. This one is even more crazy, and I'm going to get back to this particular one in a bit. We really don't want password dialogues at all, if we can avoid it. It's not adding security. And there's more than just answering a password when you talk about authentication. There might be other ways of authentication. If you're in a more enterprise environment, you might have fingerprint readers, biometric stuff. But since the way it works today is that to do an authorized thing, you need to put in a password. A lot of people confuse authorization with authentication. They are basically two different things. Authentication is the act of proving that you're someone. Authorization is whether you can do something. So I like to think of authorization as, can this process do something on some particular object, assuming there's some user using the system. I don't know. If I look at my Linux box, there's 100 different configuration files. There's no API for doing this. And this is basically what I'm trying to achieve with this PolicyKit thing. Apologies for the name. A lot of people hate the name, both the kit thing and also the camel case letter. You guys can beat me up later. So it's really as simple as this. You have a program, and you call one function. And you say, can I do this? No, you can't. So we exit. That's the core idea behind it. It's in a library with 400 other functions, and a slightly more complex API. But this is really the gist of it. Just go back once. So you have to specify what it is this user is trying to do. So you define that. If I'm like the cronchat program, and the user wants to add a cronchat entry, I need to somehow specify what that action is. So we just use an identifier namespace, reverse DNS. So if you use this stuff, you'd need to define an action right here. I don't know if you can see this like very gray XML in the back. Can you guys see it? Okay. It's not important. The important stuff is in white. So you basically define, this is your action. This could be editing the cronchat. You have a description of it. And you have what message to put up in the dialog whenever we need to ask the user to authenticate to gain this authorization. And we have some defaults, what to do if the user don't have it. So the basic model is very simple. I'm just using an example here where you want to mount a disk, a setup crypto. So if your file manager application is calling into a privilege process because mounting a disk requires privileges. So it basically checks against an authorization database, checks this process, is it allowed to do something? So it says no, you can't. It throws back an exception. This is a security boundary. It's just an example where you use IPC. It could be a set UID binary, anything else. So the file manager says, oh, I'm not allowed to do this. It gets back what action that it can't do. And it can use an authentication agent to gain an authorization if the user managed to successfully authenticate. So try to cookie down in the database, and you can now do it again, because the next time we check, we return OK. So that's basically the gist of it. It's very simple, straightforward. It's just standardized way of doing this. So there's this guy right here, authentication agent. One of the core ideas is that if you don't have an authorization, what normally happens is that you can't do anything. The user will have to look up in the manual, go edit a config file, put in the root password. And there's some things you want the user to do after they prove that they're actually the user or the administrator. So the whole, this really big dialogue is for doing that. This is an example for GNOME System to know, GNOME System Monitor. So that's a tool you can go in. You can increase the priority of your process. That's not, we don't allow that by default because it's a privileged operation. But we allow the user to prove that it's really the user, and then the GNOME system monitor process can do it. So get up a dialog, and there's a checkbox so you can remember this for future purposes. But why? Why do we even want to put up these dialogs? I said in the first place, like password dialogs are stupid and they don't make sense. There's two reasons. One is trusted path. If you have a modem, very, not a lot of people do, but if you're on the road, sometimes you use a modem, then you want to be able to dial back to get to the internet, but you don't want to have some virus running that calls a number in Russia or Denmark and charges you a lot of money, which is a very big problem they have on Windows, basically due to the huge installation base, I guess, and the general quality of the OS. And you also want to confine certain operations to the system administrator. If you have a small office, you have one admin running around, you only want him to be able to do stuff. And the other thing you might add in it is that when the application is being told, no, you're not authorized to do this, it could add a request permission button right here that will send a mail to the system administrator, and he will review whether you should have this authorization so you can do your work, whatever it is that people do. So does that make sense? It's a framework for authorizations. This is like Scary Program I wrote, just that shows the different authorizations available in Fedora 9. So this is libvirt. The action is, can you manage a virtual machine running on the system? It's a very busy dialogue. I remember my manager, Jensen Blanford, he asked me, who are you designing this for? And I don't know, I guess myself. But it shows how you can grant authorizations to different users. You can log other users out. And you can configure the implicit authorizations that will allow you to put up password dialogues and whether you can retain an authentication. So that's pretty much the gist of it. For those people who don't like the UI, there's also command line tools. But I really want to avoid them. But the problem is a distribution like Fedora or Debian, I mean, it's a general purpose OS. You can't really assume it's okay for the user to always be able to connect to the internet. You can't assume the user should always be able to access all the different positions in the system. And if you've done any work on working on a general purpose distribution, you'll certainly know that a lot of users have different opinions on what the default should be. It's horrible. So instead, we punted to the OS vendor. In Fedora, we're doing this thing called spins. Instead of a general purpose distribution, we have a desktop spin, where we open up the defaults a bit more, hoping that the user will never see the password dialogues. Otherwise, you can ask the user at install time. That's a bit silly. You can do kickstarts. And finally, a feature I'm working on is integrating it with LDAP servers, in particular the free IPA or Fedora directory server project. So you'll read all the authorizations from the directory, and the administrator of the whole enterprise can just give the users the authorizations they need and not anything more. So that way you can achieve having a very fine-grained model. How am I doing on time? Okay. How much time do I have left? Oh, cool. If you have any questions, just interrupt me. So that's basically how it works. It's a very simple API for enhancing an application to use a centralized way to determine whether a user is allowed to do something. So right now, it's been integrated so far in the new GNOME install plug. So it looks like this. The guys at Novell wrote it, and there's a lot of controversy about it, I think, because it didn't get upstream, and then Red Hat did some work. So what we added was the ability to have a small set button right there. It's actually very useful. Like when traveling here, you just press the set button. I have that authorization. I don't get a stupid dialogue. The first time I hit the set button, I got the dialogue, and I chose to keep the authorization. And just uses the standard like split between a mechanism and the actual UI. Question? Right, so the question was, what should you use PolySkid for, in a way. And in the beginning I mentioned there's basically two classes, there's settings, like the desktop background, and that uses the configuration system of the desktop. In GNOME, it's gconf. In KDE, it's kconfig. And a configuration system got all these features of defaults and mandatory and per user. And I mean, changing the desktop background is not really a privileged operation. That's more when you interact with the system, things like reconfiguring the system to what time zone it's in. It's a system-wide operation. It's not something you want to do on a server. That serves a lot of work pitches. Definitely. Well, that's only a fair observation that it's going to be creating problems, and it's yet another system that admins will have to deal with after gconf and Mozilla and OpenOffice and kconfig. It's a fundamentally different thing, though. This is restricting, really, operations which affects other users, whereas settings is per user. And it's this normally no security boundaries involved. It's a good question, definitely. So the GNOME system monitor, which is a nice tool if you like to kill your processes. So it basically shows what's happening. You'd select a process up here, and you get a small padlock on that button, and then you get a dialog. You can't retain this authorization because it's configured not to. But that's the way it works. PackageKit is a front end for RPM. Basically, it's a front end for the DIP solvers, for Yum, for apt-get, which adopts a model where you split the whole experience into the mechanism. It's a daemon running as root. And the UI, which is running unprivileged. So it uses PolySkid to ask, am I allowed to install new software? Which is a different action from, am I allowed to update this OS with packages that are signed by the OS vendor? The former, you typically don't want to give that right to untrusted users. The latter, updating your system, any user should be able to do this. It should happen automatically whenever someone is logged in. So this is a fine-grained aspect of it, where instead of you have the root password or you don't, it's I have authorization for 5 different actions, but not for 15 others, which is a very important thing, I think, to make that distinction. It may confuse a lot of admins. There's also that possibility. And other things we're working on is libvirt, got it. Most distros ship this already. The first real useful release was in October, I think. But we used stuff like hell to figure out, should you have access to this device? And normally, if you're logged in at the console, that's a Fedora and SUSE where you get access to the webcam. But what you don't want is that you have a campus deployment with a lot of workstations at a university. You have fast user switching, people log in. I log in, I get access to the webcam, then I start an application capturing video from the webcam, I leave the workstation, someone fast user switch log in, and I can just capture that video. That's kind of the thing you want to avoid. And you can do that with PolySkid because whether you're authorized depends on a lot of different things. Whether you're logged in at the console, whether you're active or not. instead of it just being, I know the root password or not. So plant things is to integrate it with the new GIO and GVFS. So from Nautilus, you should be able to drag a file into some folder owned by root, and you can authenticate and gain an authorization. And the same with gedit, if you want to edit a system-wide configuration file. Which is very useful, because the way people do that today is that they launch Nautilus and gedit as root, which is not really what you want to do. You have the whole toolkit and image loaders and I don't know what running as UID0. You want to avoid that for a number of reasons. The application also looks different because it's running as a different UID. It reads the settings from the root home directory. You get a different theme. Things like Avahi, you want to lock down people publishing services on the network, and so forth. It's one more slide. So FreeIPA, I'm working with the FreeIPA guys to read this from the directory. This is a lot more complicated than it sounds like. This have to care about coherency and caching, offline operation. And there's a few missing features. There's a lot of coverage tests on it because it deals with security. So I need to get that up to 100%. And I'm thinking maybe it can be used for parental controls in GNOME. That's an area we don't. You don't want to know. He's my daddy. He's just one feet two. So that's it. There's a lot of docs at these URLs that you probably can't read because the colors are what they are. And that's it.